voices.net. Congratulations to all the honorees, Dr. Nizar Tanir, Dr. Zaina Al-Muhtasib, Dr. Hannah Al-Sahli, and Dr. Elias Jabour, and congratulations to the National Arab American Medical Association Houston chapter for its continued success and all the work it does. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Soul Queens and Blues Kings, making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Norman Boogie Cat Sylvester and Band bring together regional rhythm and blues acts for a night of music and dance as a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon. Again, that's Soul Queens and Blues Kings making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez. If you don't already depend on a care worker to take care of your child, aging parent, family member with a disability, or even to take care of you, odds are you someday will. Care workers play a vital role in our communities. They feed, bathe, and otherwise care for those who cannot take care of themselves. In doing so, care workers make it possible for others to go to work and live their lives. Unfortunately, our society undervalues care work. Care workers get paid low wages and few benefits, all while performing physically and emotionally demanding work. That needs to change, says Melissa Unger, executive director of SEIU Local 503. SEIU Local 503 is a statewide union that represents public sector workers and caregivers. Today on Policy for the People, we talk with Melissa Unger about the challenges facing care workers, specifically those who perform long-term care work. We discuss what Oregon lawmakers should do to ensure that long-term care workers can take care of themselves and their families. One of the policies that could go a long way in improving working conditions for long-term care workers is what's known as a wage board. We end the show with a conversation with Janet Bauer, Director of Policy Research at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about the benefits of wage boards. Stay tuned. Melissa, welcome to Policy for the People.
Thank you for having me here.
One of the groups of workers that SEIU Local 503 represents is care workers. And within the sphere of care work, there is long-term care work. Can you explain to us what long-term care work entails?
the idea of long-term care is that it is care work for people with physical disabilities that are long-term, are not going to fix themselves, who are seniors, or people with developmental disabilities, that where the care that they need or the support that they need is not going to change throughout their lives. So it's going to be long-term work. The way that we often are involved is with the group of providers who do that through Medicaid, which is a federal funding stream that supports long-term care work for people who don't have the resources otherwise to get the support that they need.
And where is this work performed? Is it in the patient's home? Is it in a facility? Where is long-term care? Where does it take place?
It can actually happen in all of those places. So one of the key elements of long-term care, and it's a place where Oregon should be really proud of our work to make sure that people have choice. What is the best place for them to get the services they need? So most of our long-term care workers are home care workers and personal support workers who provide that support in home, because that is oftentimes people's preferences. But it can also support facility-based work, because we have to be honest that not everyone can make that choice. So long-term care can also be provided in facilities, an assisted living facility, a residential care facility, or a nursing home, which is more usually a short stay that has to do with acute medical needs, but also gets served through long-term care.
How big is this workforce? I'm wondering how many Oregonians are working in providing long-term care.
We alone represent about 40,000 long-term care workers, and we estimate that that's not even quite half the workforce. So we think that there's probably in the range of 95 to 120,000 long-term care workers. And these workers are overwhelmingly women and disproportionately people of color. Nationally, they're majority people of color. In Oregon, they are not majority people of color, but they are disproportionately people of color and overwhelmingly women.
How would you describe the working conditions of long-term care workers?
You know, when I think about long-term care workers, I often think about the work that home care workers did to organize a union in 2000. Their whole slogan was invisible no more. People who do this work feel invisible. They're making sure that people can live with dignity in their homes or in a facility. And oftentimes people completely just look them over. There's a real lack of, I think, view into this workforce and the critical work long-term care workers and overall care providers provide to our communities and to our families. You know, when the 1930s, when workers were allowed to organize, care work was not included in that. And that's because oftentimes these workers are immigrants, they're Black, and they're women. And so they've been excluded from many of the protections that other workers have had. And so as that has evolved over the years, it means that they are underpaid. When home care workers first organized in our union, they were paid less than $2.50 an hour. They had no taxes taken out of their paychecks, and they did not have health care.
I imagine that the work of caring for an older person or someone with a disability comes with a fair amount of physical and emotional demands. I mean, it's pretty challenging work, I imagine.
It is. It's oftentimes lifting. It's helping bathe someone. It's helping someone go to the bathroom. It's helping move someone in and out of doctor's appointments. Oftentimes, if it's in a facility, it's helping people in and out of beds. And so it's very physical work. But it's also, I think that the thing I hear from our workers the most often is just the emotional piece of it. They care so much for their consumers. And on a regular basis, consumers pass away, or they can have behavioral health challenges that can cause them to, you know, have outbursts. And so there's a constant emotional toll. And, you know, one of the things I think a lot about is like when a home care worker loses a consumer, someone that they're caring for in that person's home, sometimes that can be a relationship that's lasted for years, and they die, they don't get a day paid off after that. They don't get any support. There's no system set up to make sure that that person's job continues.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which is the wages of workers in this sector. I'm wondering if you can tell us what the latest numbers show in terms of what long-term care workers get paid.
You know, it is a range. And I will say, you know, we've had been able to make real progress for unionized caregivers in the last couple of years, but it's still very low. So home care workers' wages are now $17.77 an hour. And to put that in context, they're doing this very hard work where I think Target might now have a starting wage of $24. But at the same time, they often don't have full-time work. And so most home care and personal support workers often find themselves making under $20,000 a year because they don't have full-time work, and they don't, you know, they have to piece together all of these consumers to be able to even create full-time work. So oftentimes people are working 10, 15 hours a week. For nursing home workers, it's, you know, it's definitely a range, but just for a CNA who has to get training, pass a test, and have a license, their wages will often range between, at a unionized facility, between $20 and $27. And that is after massive work during the pandemic to increase wages. And I think that while that is progress, it's clearly not enough, and it does not represent the difficulty of their work and doesn't represent really the reliance we have on as a society for them doing their work. And I think the other thing I would highlight is that it's not just about wages, it's also about access to benefits and healthcare. And so, you know, we've been working very hard to create an accessible healthcare plan. But just one example is in a nursing home that we represent, we just got a new healthcare plan and worked really hard both with the state to help support healthcare for essential long-term care workers and with employers. But there was a member that we had that was paying $800 a month for their premium share for themselves, their spouse, and their child. And that is not uncommon. And then the healthcare they had an $18,000 out-of-pocket maximum. So the reality is that healthcare was not accessible and affordable. It was only for emergencies. The idea that people who are putting, you know, their whole job is keeping other people healthy and don't have healthcare is a huge problem.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Melissa Unger, Executive Director of SEIU Local 503, about the challenges facing long-term care workers in Oregon. What have you heard from long-term care workers in terms of their ability to make ends meet, in terms of their ability to take care of themselves and their families?
Well, I'll just tell you a story I heard yesterday. I was with long-term care workers in Salem telling their stories. And one of our workers shared with a legislator that she had a consumer, a client that she was working with who, for some reason, that work ended. She immediately was left with no work. And there's no system to help find another consumer. So in that gap, she lost her place to live. And now she has a new consumer a couple weeks later, but she now no longer is able to stay because she wasn't able to pay rent. And she now has to have three, you know, a first and a last month's rent to be able to find some place to live, but she hasn't been able to work long enough to be able to actually pay that first and last month's rent. That is, I think, the indication of how on the edge every one of these workers is working. In that same meeting, I heard about two other caregivers who are living in a trailer or living in a car. Because they can't afford to rent in the communities they live in and in the communities they care in. If someone is caring for someone to make sure another family can function, they should be able to provide for themselves. And what I hear every day is that's not true.
Yeah, it seems that if for workers who are providing care to others, to our loved ones, to ourselves, we want them to be able to take care of themselves as well, just for their own physical and mental well-being, that if they're better off in that respect, so are we.
We as families and as communities could not function without the support of care workers. And yet they are often some of the most underpaid workers in our economy. And I don't think that that can be divorced from the fact that they are women and women of color. And we have to really readjust to the role they play in our communities, in our families, and respect that role and understand that if we don't, people will not continue to do this work. There's a huge workforce shortage, and yet we still haven't figured out that some of this is about respect, valuing the work, and doing that by giving workers the same protections and the same rights that workers throughout our industry have. And I think I would be remiss to not highlight the government is the major funder of long-term care work when it comes to Medicaid. And yet government is making a decision many times to make this the system of low wages And employers are a part of that too. I do not want to let employers off the hook. They're making decisions and often making profit by underpaying folks. But government also has the control to change this dynamic. And so we really think it's a key element to figuring out how to make progress for care workers is employers, workers, and government coming together and deciding what kind of state do we want to be where we're lifting up this work and celebrating this work. I often think about the fact that we have done that in a lot of ways around construction trades. We have a wage, the government sets a wage standard through a prevailing wage for government for construction workers who are oftentimes men, overwhelmingly men. And they have that system where they don't give employers choice. They have to pay a certain rate if they're going to get government dollars. Yet when it comes to care work, which is as equally and maybe even more government supported, they have none of those same standards. And I think that we should really be asking government why there's different standards for these different types of work that government supports and pays for.
You mentioned the high turnover in the industry, which is perhaps not surprising given that it's very demanding work and not paid very well. And I'm wondering what this high turnover rate means for clients, for the workers, for the industry as a whole.
You know, one of our members, Joy Willman, tells a story a lot about a consumer who has gotten long-term care supports for a very long time and can't really get out of bed without a care provider. So, you know, 24 hours a day, they have caregivers who come support them. And they talk about how this one time, an agency that was helping provide home care work for this consumer subbed out a worker without any notification to the consumer because the worker quit their job. And so that person was in bed. Someone they did not know walked into their home and came to help get them out of bed and bathe them. Someone they'd never met. And they didn't even know it wasn't going to be the person they were expecting. And I think that story really highlights to me the impact on consumers when there is high turnover, and also just like the everyday relationship that's built between a caregiver and a consumer. And so the high turnover has real impact. If you're training someone on how your oven works, about what type of food you like, about how you like to be bathed, about how you like to be supported to get in and out of bed or use the toilet, and that person is changing on a daily basis or on a weekly or monthly basis, it's traumatic in some ways. So that's one example of, I think, how high turnover impacts consumers. But another example is that many consumers just can't find a worker because there's not enough workers. And then the last example is in facilities. Our members who work in facilities right now are often completely short-staffed, and they find themselves in a situation where they are running all day long to try to get to somebody when they ring their bell. And, you know, the consumer has every right to be upset that it takes an hour and a half for someone to get there, but then they will often learn that there's only two people on shift because there's not enough people to fill the shifts. And that is oftentimes a choice that employers are making if they're understaffing facilities. But right now, it's really indicative of the workforce crisis that's impacting this entire industry, where people cannot hire people, because if you're paying $21 to help someone go to the bathroom and bathe them and deal with all the emotional work it takes, and that same person can make $21 across the street at a Target, it's a real hard case to make that this is the right job for them.
And it would seem that the demand for long-term care workers is only going to grow in the years and decades to come because our population is aging. So there's going to be more people needing care. I'm wondering if you've seen any data on that point.
It's one of the fastest growing industries. In Oregon, it's expected to increase by 24% between 2020 and 2030. And I can tell you from, you know, working with over 40,000 workers in this industry, and also just, you know, really being with the employers and on the ground with government as they're trying to deal with this, our state is completely unprepared for that increase. And the impact will be people going without care or going with inadequate care.
I want to switch gears here and talk about what can be done at the policy level to improve working conditions for long-term care workers. And you already begun to describe some of the things that could be done. You reference establishing a board that sets standards. What would you like to see the Oregon legislature do in this regard?
I feel like there has to be a real focus on this industry and on these workers. you know, we often try to like recruit jobs to Oregon. These are jobs that are here and are going to only grow. So what is the legislature's responsibility to lean in and focus on these jobs? Especially because these are jobs that government actually funds. So one thing I want them to do is have a more robust, stronger conversation about this industry, this work, the fact that Oregonians rely on it so much and they support it. And so how do we get them to just really engage like they do on many other workforce issues, I believe. So that's one piece. But two, I do really believe at the core that they should figure out what is their role in setting standards. So, you know, we introduced a bill this legislative session called Senate Bill 602. That bill is really about how do you get together government, workers, employers, and consumers, and really say like, what is needed in this industry? What is needed in terms of wages? What is needed in terms of benefits? What is needed in terms of workforce enhancements? So that we can make sure as a state, we have a plan.
As I understand it, Senate Bill 602 that you referenced is not moving forward this session. I'm wondering if you can talk about the legislature's decision not to advance it. It seems a missed opportunity, and what the way forward may be in the years to come in terms of advancing this idea.
I mean, I think that the reality is like new ideas like this often take time. This is just a moment. We got to introduce the idea. We got to hear people's support for the idea and also people's opposition to it and think about how do we come back and continue to make this case. I really do believe that we'll be back next session and the session after that to get the government to really think about their role in this. I think that we made progress.
Melissa, as we wrap up, let me ask you, are there any final thoughts regarding long-term care workers that you would like to share with us?
I believe long-term care workers are the backbone of our economy in many ways, just like childcare workers. I mean, caregivers really make sure that our economy works. They make sure that people can go to work. When I had kids, I was able to go to work because someone was able to watch them. And that's the same as people who are caring for aging parents or people who have a child with a developmental disability. And so the fact that they aren't honored in the way that they should be and respected in the way they should be underestimates that they are the fundamental foundation of how our economy functions every day. So I just hope that we can start to give them the respect they deserve for the fact that they make our entire system work.
Well, Melissa Unger, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Juan Carlos. This has been very fun. And anytime I can talk about the women and the women of color who do this work, I'm happy to do that.
That was Melissa Unger, Executive Director of SEIU Local 503, discussing the challenges facing long-term care workers and what policymakers ought to do in response. In the rest of the show, we go deeper into one of the ideas mentioned by Melissa, a policy known as a wage board. My colleague at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Janet Bauer, recently wrote a paper about wage boards. So I asked Janet to explain what a wage board is and why it's a good idea.
The significance of wage boards is that they are effective in boosting wages and improving working conditions for workers across an entire industry. The wage boards are made up of some workers and employers in the industry and the public. And they are typically set up by the state legislature, but sometimes even by local government. Their recommendations have weight, and public officials typically must implement them. Some wage boards even have the power themselves to set standards.
So in the paper, you state that wage boards can help heal what ails the labor market. And I'm wondering in what way wage boards address some of the challenges that workers currently face.
Wage boards are actually a good fit for some longstanding problems that we've been having in the labor market, and also some new ones that have become more evident over the last decade or so. We all know about the wage gap and that women, and particularly women of color, are paid less than men. A primary driver of it is occupational segregation by gender, meaning that occupations where women tend to predominate get lower compensation than occupations where men do. Long-term care workers are a very good example of that. So wage boards, in setting standards across an industry that is predominated by women, can help basically shrink that wage gap. One thing that has been more prominent, though, that wage boards are a good fit for is the effect of outsourcing. Companies, even large companies, are outsourcing their HR departments, their payroll, their accounting. Some even contract out for core activities. For instance, there are some restaurants who use a labor agency to provide much of the kitchen staff. This kind of splintering of the workforce, where there's many levels of employers, makes it hard for workers to organize in a traditional fashion because they're spread out over many businesses. They may not even know exactly who their employer is. And since wage boards span an entire industry, they basically can overcome the disadvantage that the splintered workforce has in exercising some say-so in their workplace. Lastly, some workers are exploited simply because of their immigration status. And we know this, we see this in farm work, in housekeeping and domestic work. They're just simply vulnerable to wage theft and exploitation because often they're afraid to complain to state authorities. In industries where there are a lot of immigrants, wage boards can really help.
So in recent years, we've seen in Oregon and nationwide a great deal of worker organizing. Starbucks workers, of course, to workers in the healthcare sector, to workers in many other companies and industries. And that's really encouraging news, since we know that a strong labor movement is key to creating an economy that works for everyone. And how do you see wage boards interacting with efforts to organize the workplace?
Yeah, I think that the movement that you mentioned is really important and it needs to continue. You know, most workers in Oregon and across the country are not in a union, do not get those benefits. And traditional organizing has a huge role in helping them. We have a long way to go, and wage boards can be a complement. I also will say that wage boards work best when the workforce has some organizing happening in it. And that's because those wage boards are effective only to the extent that they really respond to what's going on for workers.
So you mentioned earlier that wage boards can improve wages and working conditions for workers in an entire industry. I'm wondering if wage boards can also be good for the companies that employ those workers.
Well, we have looked into this, and the truth is that they do help businesses because they promote a more stable workforce. In low-wage industries, there's a lot of turnover. And when jobs actually work better for workers, workers tend to stay. So the investment that employers make in their workers pays off more when workers stay and they have a stable workforce. The other thing is that the exploitive employers who tend to underpay and underinvest in their workers no longer have this competitive advantage over an employer who is trying to make their jobs work well for their workers. So a wage board, by boosting those standards for everyone, removes that competitive advantage that exploitive employers have when they undercut the standards in their industry.
I'm wondering what you can tell us about
the history of this idea of wage boards, where it comes from, and where we see it in action.
Wage boards were prominent early in the 20th century, and they were instrumental in addressing the exploitation of women's labor. But what's interesting is that we're seeing a resurgence of wage boards. In 2019, New York established a board for farm workers. And Nevada, in 2021, created an employment standards board to recommend compensation and improve working conditions for home care workers in the state. And last year, California created a wage board for fast food workers. So we are seeing this idea crop up again. And I think that people are seeing that it is a tool that can be effective in combination with worksite organizing to give more power to workers to address, you know, lack of living wages and hazardous working conditions.
Well, Janet, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Juan Carlos.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next
time. Hi, it's Al Franken telling you to listen to KBOO, KBOO, Community Radio 90.7 here in Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Jeff Godsell revisits the early Couple on the Run film noir, Gun Crazy, from 1950. And then we reprise Britta Gordon's review of Christian Petzold's Undine from 2021. But first, Matthew of KBOO's monthly bedtime story program, Gremlin Time, looks at the Hong Kong action film, My Young Auntie.
Among the many nice box sets of movies that are out nowadays comes a nice collection